Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves, presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp for your chance to win a $200 tattered cover gift certificate. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute. It's time to begin.
Good evening. Welcome to the Tattered Cover Bookstore on Colfax Avenue. Thank you so much for coming out tonight. Thank you for supporting our author events, and we really appreciate you supporting independent bookstores. Now, tonight's going to go a little differently than usual because, unfortunately, our guest has a bit of laryngitis. So I might be helping him out in the readings, and I hope you'll bear with me. I've been practicing, so... But hopefully it will all go well, but I just wanted to tell you he's really very sad to have laryngitis. So anyway, and he's lucky that this is the end of the tour and not the beginning, too. Tonight, it's my pleasure to introduce Abraham Verghese, who will talk about his debut novel, Cutting for Stone, a sweeping family saga of Africa and America, doctors and patients, exile and home. It's a story of twin brothers born of a secret union between a beautiful Indian nun and a British surgeon in a mission hospital in Ethiopia. It's an unforgettable journey into one man's remarkable life and the curious beauty of the work of healing others. Abraham Verghese is also the author of two nonfiction books, The Tennis Partner, a New York Times notable book, and My Own Country, a National Book Critics Circle finalist. He's board certified in internal medicine and in pulmonary and infectious diseases. He attended the Iowa Writers Workshop at the University of Iowa, where he earned his MFA, and he's currently on the faculty at Stanford University as Senior Associate Chair and Professor of Theory and Practice of Medicine in the Department of Medicine, and he lives in California. Please welcome Abraham Verghese.
Thank you very much. I've been saving my voice all day, so we'll see how this goes. It's such a pleasure to be here back at the Tattered Cover. I've been noticing on the book tour that booksellers will come up to me and say, you need to read this book. It's almost like they're diagnosticians and they see some pallor or jaundice. And it made me realize that in these hard economic times, I think books have never been more important. I've always thought that I've always thought that novels are instructions for living. That's what they really are all about when they work. And so booksellers are very quick to tell you what particular instructions you need. And so this is the tail end of my tour. I've collected lots and lots of books, and now I can go and read them. As you can tell, my voice is really quite fragile. So I think I'm going to ask Lisa if she wouldn't mind helping me with the first reading. I'll just set it up a bit. I'll say that I began this book with an image of a very beautiful South Indian nun. And I had this image of her for a long, long time. And my image of her was that she was in a mission hospital in Africa and suddenly one day goes into labor without any warning. Maybe she had some warning, but nobody else did. And that's really the scene that opens the book. And as you know, if you've read a few pages, the labor is catastrophic. And she dies during the whole process. And one of the twins, one of her sons, becomes the narrator for the story. And in the particular piece that Lisa will read to you now, this actually goes back 7 years before the labor when, as a young nun, she was making her way across the ocean to Africa. And she's with another nun, Sister Anjali. And as they're making this voyage, a very, very rough sea, a terrible ship, all of a sudden a big shipboard fever breaks out. And she goes looking for an English surgeon by the name of Thomas Stone, who's on board, who's also making this journey. And Thomas Stone is important because everyone believes 7 years later that he is the father of the twins. So, Lisa, if you'd take it from there. Thank you.
Now seeking medical help, Sister Mary Joseph Praise gathered her courage to knock on his cabin. A faint voice bid her to enter. A bilious acetone odor greeted her. "It's me," she called out. "It's Sister Mary Joseph Praise." The doctor lay on his side in his bunk, his skin the same shade as his khaki shorts, his eyes screwed shut. "Doctor," she said, hesitating, "are you also with fever?" When he tried to look at her, his eyeballs rolled like marbles on a tilting plate. He turned and retched over the fire bucket, missed it, which didn't matter, as the bucket was full to the brim. Sister Mary Joseph Praise rushed forward and felt his brow. It was cold and clammy, not at all feverish. His cheeks were hollowed and his body looked as if it had shrunk to fit in the tiny cabin. None of the passengers had been spared the seasickness, but the Englishman's affliction was severe. "Doctor, I'm wanting to report a fever that has affected 5 patients. It comes with rash, chills, and sweat, a slow pulse, and a loss of appetite. All are stable, except for Sister Anjali. Doctor, I'm most worried about Anjali." She felt better once it was off her chest, even though, other than letting out a moan, the Englishman made no response. His eyes fell on the catgut ligature that was looped around the bed rail near his hands and that displayed knot thrown upon knot, 10 of them. The knots were so plentiful that the thread stood up like a gnarled flagpole. This was how he'd logged the hours, or kept track of his bouts of emesis. She rinsed out the bucket and put it back within his reach. She mopped the mess on the floor with a towel. Then she rinsed the towel out and hung it up to dry. She brought water to his side. She withdrew, wondering how many days it had been since he'd eaten anything. By evening, he was worse. Sister Mary Joseph Praise brought sheets, towels, and broth. Kneeling, she tried to feed him, but the smell of food triggered dry heaves. His eyeballs had sunk into their orbits. His shriveled tongue looked like that of a parrot. She recognized the room's fruity odor as the scent of starvation. When she pinched up a skin fold at the back of his arm and let go, it stayed up like a tent. Like the buckled deck. The bucket was half full of clear liquid. He babbled about green fields and was unaware of her presence. Could seasickness be fatal, she wondered? Or could he have the form frust of the fever that afflicted Sister Anjali? There was so much she did not know about medicine. In the middle of the ocean, surrounded by the sick, she felt the weight of her ignorance. But she knew how to nurse, and she knew how to pray. So praying, she eased off his shirt, which was stiff with bile and spit, and she slid down his shorts. As she gave him a bed bath, she was self-conscious, for she'd never ministered to a white man, or to a doctor, for that matter. His skin displayed a wave of goosebumps at the touch of her cloth, but the skin was free of the rash she'd seen on the 4 passengers and the 1 cabin boy who'd come down with the fever. The fine translucent coat of his hair on his chest and abdomen looked as if it had drifted up from the mother load of hair at his pubis. She dispassionately cleaned his uncircumcised member and then flopped it to one side and attended to the wrinkled and helpless-looking sack beneath. She washed his feet and cried while she did, thinking inevitably of her sweet Lord and his last earthly night with his disciples.
I deliberately stopped the reading there because I don't want to give away too much. You have to read further to see what happens on the ship. The boys in the twins are raised in this hospital by a couple who are Indian physicians. The man is Ghosh. He's an internist, but he becomes the reluctant surgeon in this hospital. The woman's name is Hema. And Thomas Stone disappears. Thomas Stone, everyone suspects, is the father. Thomas Stone himself feels he must be the father, but he has no earthly idea how it could have happened. And you really have to read almost to the end of the book to find out if it happened, and if so, how it happened. But in this particular scene that I want to have Lisa read to you, this is a scene where Marion, the young narrator, is assisting his father, Dr. Ghosh. She says he's assisting him in a vasectomy. And Dr. Ghosh is a reluctant surgeon, but he's always done vasectomies. That's one operation he's been very good at. And in this scene, he's instructing Dr. Cooper from the American Embassy.
Dr. Cooper arrived promptly at 8 that evening in an embassy staff car, just as his patient, a Polish gentleman, pulled up in his kombi. Dr. Ghosh, my father, learned the technique of vasectomy as an intern, and he'd learned it directly from Javert in India, whom he spoke of as the maestro of male nut clipping, who was personally responsible for millions of people not being here. The operation was a novelty in Ethiopia, and now expatriate men, particularly Catholics, came to Ghosh in increasing numbers for an operation that was uncommon or unavailable in their countries. I have a proposition for you, Dr. Cooper. I shall teach you the vasectomy, and once you are proficient, you can pay me back by doing a vasectomy on a VIP patient, Ghosh said. Do I know him? Cooper said. You're talking to him, Ghosh said. So you see, I have a vested interest in seeing you are superbly trained. My assistant, Marion, will help me judge your skills. Marion, not a word to Hema. You either, Cooper. About my plans, please. Cooper had a stiff brush cut and overlapping square teeth that looked like chiclets. His American accent was sharp, jarring to the ear, but offset by the way he drawled out his words, by his relaxed, affable manner, as if he'd never had an unpleasant moment in his life and did not expect to. See one, do one, teach one, right, old buddy? Cooper said. Indeed, yes, Ghosh said. It is easy to do, but harder than it looks. Some preliminaries, Dr. Cooper. I tell the patient to use an enema the night before because nothing makes them more tense than being constipated. Warm milk and honey mixed together and put into an enema bag held shoulder high is what I recommend. Does it work? Does it work? Let me put it this way. If the patient happens to be drinking a whiskey and soda, it'll suck the glass right out of your hand. Gotcha, said Cooper. I also asked the patient to take a warm bath beforehand. It relaxes him, he added sotto voce. It improves my olfactory experience, you know. The patient hadn't said a word thus far. He was, Ghosh had told me, a consultant to the Economic Commission of Africa, an expert on population control, who happened to be the father of 5 girls. He didn't mind all the attention. We can't finish if we don't start, so we'd better start. Yes, Marion? The heater, please. I'd already turned on the electric heater under the table. Here is my first caveat, Ghosh said. If you don't want the scrotum to shrivel up and the balls to retract to the armpit, the room has to be really warm. Now, my second caveat is relaxation. Very important. A barbiturate or narcotic might help. I recommend an ounce of Johnny Walker Red or Black. I'm not particular. A wonderful relaxant. And, yes, you might give one to the patient, too. Cooper's laugh rolled leisurely out of his mouth like great banks of clouds that spilled over the Entoto Mountains. I served the patient as Johnny Walker, which he downed in one gulp. I loved assisting Ghosh. Ever since he treated me as if I were old enough to learn and understand, I took my role very seriously. I was thrilled to have Cooper there watching. Ghosh, on the patient's right, rooted with his thumb and index finger at the top right of the scrotum, just where it joined the body. You feel all the wiry things, lymph vessels, arteries, nerves, and whatnot? Well, the vast difference is in that lot. And with practice, you can tell it apart from all the other wires. It has the largest wall-to-lumen ratio of any tubular structure in the body. Believe it or not, here it is, a whip-like structure. Put your finger behind mine. Cooper rooted around and said, "Got it, the vas. Yep." Now, push the vas forward from the back with the tip of your index finger. Fix it like this against the pulp of your finger so that it doesn't slip away. Ghosh's instructions to Cooper were similar to what he'd said to me when I assisted him. He loved to teach, and in Cooper he had the kind of student he deserved. If he dazzled Cooper with polished delivery, it was because he practiced it on me. Practicing medicine and teaching medicine were completely connected for Ghosh. When there was no one to instruct, he suffered, but that was rare. He would happily teach a probationer or even a family member, whoever happened to be around. I use adrenaline with my local anesthetic to keep the bleeding minimal, and don't be stingy. He emptied a 5cc syringe of local into the tissue that his index finger pushed forward. Less than that, and he'll have pain, and the balls will go up to the armpit. You'll have to call a chest surgeon to bring them down. Now, see how my index finger still has the vas stretched over it? I make a tiny cut in the scrotal skin. I keep pushing on the vas, pushing it forward, and there. When I see it in the wound, I use the Alice to grip the vas. He pulled out a short length of pale, white, worm-like tissue. I put a mosquito clip here and here, and then I cut between the clips. I remove a 2-centimeter segment. Ideally, you send it to pathology. That way, if his wife gets pregnant a year from now, you can show the patient the pathology report, and he'll know that it's not because you didn't do your job, but because a third party did his job better. I don't send it to pathology for the simple reason that we don't have a pathologist. But for a while, there was a pathologist at the American Embassy clinic in Beirut. I'd do vasectomies for the American staff and send him these little pieces I cut out. The man did pathology for all the American embassies in East and West Africa. He kept sending back reports that my specimens were inadequate, though he thought he saw some uroepithelial tissue. He couldn't be certain it was the vas. "It's the vas," I wrote back to him each time. "What other uroepithelial tissue could I have cut into?" Call it the vas, but he kept complaining, "Cannot be certain, not enough tissue." It was starting to annoy me, you know? So finally, I sent him a pair of sheep's balls. I put them in formalin and sent them off in the same diplomatic pouch with a note, "Is this enough tissue?" Never had a problem with him after that. Now I tie off the cut ends with catgut, and then I tell the patient, "No communication with the wife allowed for the next 30 days. Ghosh turned to face the patient and repeated, "No communication with the wife allowed for the next 30 days. The patient nodded, okay, you can communicate, say good morning, darling, and all that, but no sex for 3 months. The patient grinned, okay, you can have sex, but you must wear a condom. "I use Interruptus," the patient said, speaking for the first time in a heavy European, East European accent. "You use what? Interruptus? Pull and pray? Good God, man, no wonder you have 5 kids. It's noble of you to try and get off the train at an earlier station, but it's unreliable." "No, sir," interrupt the Interruptus man, "unless you want to reach your half dozen this year." The patient looked embarrassed. "You know what we call young men who use coitus interruptus," Ghosh said. The population expert shook his head. "We call them father, daddy, pater, papa, pear. No, sir, I've done the interrupting for you. Give me 3 months, and you can tell your missus that she is not to worry, because you will be shooting blanks, and there will be no more interruptions, and you will be staying for dessert, coffee, and cigars."
Thank you so much for doing that so very well. Better than me, I think. Again, I'm deeply apologetic that my voice has let me down. I must tell you that I chose that particular section not because I want to offend anybody. In fact, I read it at a medical school a few weeks ago, and the professor of medicine came up to me and said that there wasn't a dry seat in the house at the end of the reading. I don't know if that was a compliment or not, but that piece is fairly self-contained. It doesn't have repercussions with the plot, and it's the reason that I picked that. Thank you for doing that so very well. I appreciate that. I'll stop with that. Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we've been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp for your chance to win a $200 Tattered Cover gift certificate and learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.